Imagine you're a Venetian merchant in the year 1550. You open an opulent gilded atlas and trace your finger along a line. It starts in Spain and snakes its way down through the Atlantic Ocean. It slips underneath South America, glides into the Pacific, and makes a pit stop in the Philippines. Soon enough, your finger finds itself back in a port on the southern edge of Spain. Close the atlas, look beyond your ships to the deep blue lagoon. Suddenly, the world feels so much smaller. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculimundi exploration. In this series, we hear from those who live, love and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. If these walls could talk, you'd hear tales of expeditions to remote islands, tips on avoiding frostbite as you circumnavigate the poles, and whispers of impenetrable mountain passes. At the heart of this building sits an impressive collection made up of 2 million documents, from maps, artifacts to paintings, spanning 500 years of history, exploration and geographical knowledge. You might have guessed, I'm at the Royal Geographical Society's library and here to meet Dr. Katie Parker, the RGS's Cartographic Collections Manager. Part curator, part librarian, Katie previously worked as a map researcher for Barry Lawrence Rudiman Antique Maps. At her fingertips are some of the rarest maps in the UK, and she's able to get them out for the general public, for research purposes, of course. Now, this is a rather special version of What's Your Map, because we'll be going over two versions of the same map. The map that we're going to look at today is in the Sunderland Collection, which is available to consult online via oculi-mundi.com/podcast. And then we're in for a very special treat because Katie's going to be showing us your version of this map that's here at the Royal Geographical Society. Katie, thanks for joining me on What's Your Map?
Well, thank you for making the trek to South Kensington. It's a real honour to be on the podcast.
We have this amazing and very beautiful map up here on the screen. Can you just describe it? Tell me the who, what, and where about this map.
Sure. So this is a world map that is part of a manuscript atlas by Battista Agnesi. It is a world map in an oval projection, so it's an elliptical projection. And the world in that oval is showing us things we'd recognize. So we see South America looks pretty clear to us. Africa is recognizable, Europe, most of Asia. But you notice there towards the north of Asia, it fades into kind of nothing. Mm. Same with the northwest of North America. So this is the world as it was known to Battista Agnesi around 1550. The green continents are surrounded by gorgeous wind heads that are showing us the different directions of the wind, which would have been important to navigation at the time, but are also of aesthetic value that we see here. And then an important feature, particularly of this map, is that we have a ship's track on it. We have a ship's track leaving from the Iberian Peninsula, going through the Straits of Magellan, and then going across the Pacific to the Philippines, and then back south of Africa and back to Europe. And this is one of the first times we see a ship track like that on a world map like this.
It's incredibly beautiful. I mean, this route of Magellan's, which is the first known circumnavigation in 1519 to 1522, we'll talk a little bit about that, is on the map. So it's very up to date and, as it were, very much part of science and exploration of that early 16th century moment. But then these incredible wind heads, Katie, that surround the map and have their classical terminologies, it's very beautiful. It's stunning because they're in this kind of lovely blue. And as you say, the continents are in green. So there's something very aesthetic and very classical about this map as much as its up-to-date science and technological moment. What's going on there, this kind of interesting fusion between the two, the past
Absolutely.
And the present?
So this is an indication that this item is an elite object meant as kind of a luxury. So the people that would have this in their library would have paid a lot of money to Agnesi to get these atlases, which were a sign that basically they were members of a cosmopolitan imperial world. So if you were going to own one of these atlases, you were probably related in some way to navigation, to maritime commerce and trade. So you might have been a merchant, you might have been an official, you might have been a nobleman, as many of the owners of these surviving atlases were. And so you're showing off that you are up to date, you are aware of all of these global events that are really changing the world in the mid-16th century for Europeans, while at the same time, you are a valuer of aesthetics. You probably know quite a bit about art, and the goal here is to approximate a medieval illuminated manuscript, which also would have been a kind of next volume over in the libraries of these primarily men who owned these volumes.
And just looking at it in a bit more detail, Katie, you see the track of Magellan's voyage. And then there's another track that you see across the Atlantic, this golden track. What's that?
It is very appropriately heightened in gold. So much of the line work in this map is heightened in gold. So it has gold leaf that's applied onto it. And that line specifically is heightened in gold because it is gold and mainly actually silver that is going to be transported across that route, which is the route from Peru, from San Luis de Potosí, over the Panama Isthmus of Panama. At that time, there's obviously no canal for a couple hundred years, and then across the Atlantic back to Spain, which is the route of their riches that are going to then fund imperial expansion, not only in Spain, but eventually all imperial expansion for all of Europe.
And with the Magellan route, so the Magellan route is really about spices, isn't it? Because you see in the top right-hand corner of the map, you see the Indonesian archipelago, which is the Moluccas Islands. And this is really a map which is showing that imperial contestation, not only for the silver of the New World, but also the spices of Southeast Asia. And this is a kind of battle between Portugal and Spain, which this map is really capturing at that mid-16th century moment. Would that be fair?
Absolutely. And it really tells you that this is an imperial map telling the story of the age, which is imperial expansion. And that imperial expansion is funded by silver from South America, but it is in search of access to Chinese markets and to the riches of the East Indies, specifically spices. And so Magellan, when he set out going west, he was actually, the goal was to get to the east. So he sails down south, does manage to get through what are now called the Straits of Magellan. So that was very lucky for him. And then across the Pacific. The problem for Magellan is the Pacific was much wider than he ever anticipated. So he and his crew have quite a rough go of it. And they finally do make it across the very, very wide Pacific to the Philippines, where actually Magellan is going to exit stage left. He is not going to make it. He is killed in the Philippines. And then only a few members of his crew are able to limp back around across the Atlantic to Europe. But the goal was always to access those spices and to really claim them for Spain, because the Portuguese had some control there. They had already set up a spice route, and Spain wanted to see if they could get one that was more efficient. And the answer was, no, they can't.
So actually, the map is interesting because it shows what we call Magellan's first circumnavigation, but it's not, because Magellan dies along the way, and it's not a circumnavigation because that's not the plan. The plan is to come back the same way that they go. But, and it's very much your research area around the Pacific, everybody misunderstands the size of the Pacific, which is why they start going west to get to the east. This is kind of amazing, I think, that this massive error drives so much of the exploration at the time.
Indeed, it's an error, or I guess it's also an idea of approximation to risk. Some people are willing to risk it and others are not. Obviously, Magellan's crew on the way back said, absolutely not, we're not doing that again. It was terrible. But in every generation or so, there's going to be more people that do want to go. And we're going to see in the 1560s, the Spanish are going to send a new set of voyages to try and see if they can again find a more efficient route to China. And they are going to set that up. And that's going to be actually the other side of what's called the galleon route. So one side is what is the line shown in gold here, which are the galleons bringing silver back to Spain. The other galleon route is going to be taking silver to the Philippines, to Manila specifically, and then that is where they're going to trade with China, which is the main goal. So this is one half of a route that is eventually going to allow Spain to really dominate into the 17th century.
And to truly have a kind of global image of trade that goes right around the globe. I think it is interesting, isn't it? This, you could almost say that this is a very early map of sort of globalization, because it is about that European outreach and expansion. It's driven by trade. This is not about some romantic idea of exploration and discovery. It is about silver. It's about spices. It's about multinational tracking across the ocean. Who was Magellan? Just tell me a little bit about his history.
So Magellan is a Portuguese, what we would now call explorer. Of course, at the time, that word doesn't exist. I would more rightly classify him, I think, as an adventurer. And I think that more rightly captures the opportunistic sense in which he is trying. So he is trying to basically get funding to allow him to go on this expedition. He has a hunch that he can get to the east faster than anyone else. And basically, it is a venture. So he wants investors. And then if this works out, he'll get lots of money from it. If not, hopefully those investors will take the brunt of the pain financially. And then he can have another expedition.
What happens to Magellan?
So Magellan does make it across the Pacific, just barely. He's losing men and ship like flies as they go, because he miscalculated quite how wide the Pacific would end up being. He encounters a few islands along the way, which we see here. So you see the island of Sao Paulo and then of Tiburones, which is the island of sharks. So those are islands that he gave European names, although they might have had previous names, particularly from Polynesians. Continued across. The unfortunate thing about the way that most Europeans cross the Pacific is that they end up not actually encountering that many islands. And that has to do with the currents and the way that the winds work. So you do have a long, hard go of it in between those two spaces. And then as we get to the other side of the map, we see that we're encountering other islands, including the Isla de Ladrones, which is the island of thieves, which tells you the kind of encounters from Magellan's point of view. Of course, if you ask the islanders, they probably had a very different opinion about that encounter and would not classify themselves as thieves. And then you get to the Philippines, whereas Magellan, in a different confrontation with indigenous peoples, is going to be killed. And then it's going to be a different set or the remains of his crew that are going to literally limp back in one ship to Spain. And they're going to be led by a guy named Elcano. So our Basque listeners would really want me to identify him as coming from the Basque country.
So he's really the first circumnavigator
Indeed.
Of the globe.
And they, if you go to Basque country, they will call it the Elcano expedition. They will not call it the Magellan expedition.
Before we talk further about Agnese's atlas, which you can see in high resolution on oculi-mundi.com, I'd like for you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From mapping sounds to charting constellations, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series, or the next. Now I want to hear more about who Agnese was. What do we know about the map maker and his background?
Very, very little. We don't have much beyond basically where he is from and where he worked. So we know from his signatures in about 25 of the extant 78 or so atlases we have that he made, that he is from Genoa and that he had a workshop in Venice. But beyond that, we don't know life dates. We don't know any family background or anything, which is a bit rare actually for mapmakers from this period. Usually we can cobble together some more information, but Battista Agnese really remains a mystery.
And coming from Genoa and then working in Venice, having a workshop, churning out these incredible maps. That's quite interesting, isn't it? Because Genoa and Venice very much defined by maritime history and trade. So it makes sense in a way that he's working in map making, because that's coming out of that sort of seaborne history, right?
It is a very wet kind of culture that's happening here, and it is very maritime based. But interestingly, Genoa and Venice at this time, Genoa's kind of on the wane, Venice is on the rise, but they are competitors as well. So I think it is indicative of the power of Venice that someone from Genoa would think they had a better business opportunity by moving there, even if it was kind of their rival team, as it were, and had been his whole life. Mm-hmm. So it's a real conscious choice, I would imagine, that he set up there and thought that that was a better place to get his clients, which include Henry VIII, Charles V, Philip II of Spain. So it's really a who's who list of 16th century Europe. And so he is well placed within Venice to reach all of those people.
That is extraordinary. So, I mean, he's working with just the biggest imperial clients in the world, pretty much, and producing this kind of map. The wind heads are written in Latin, and I'm just interested in the way the language works. And what for you is interesting, Katie, about what is on this map in terms of also the places as well? Anything particularly significant?
Indeed. So I'm very interested in the how many cities we seem to have in South America, particularly in what is today Peru. So we see Cusco in the middle there, which people have probably heard of. And that, again, indicates the importance of the silver extraction that is happening there and of the imperial expansion that's happening there at the expense of indigenous peoples. And then I'm also very interested in, if you look in the middle of Mexico, you see a large lake that then seems to have settlements in it. And this is labeled on the map as Temistitlan, which is a derivation of Tenochtitlan, which is the Nahuatl word for the Aztecs and their capital city, which was indeed in the middle of a large lake, although today, obviously, the lake is gone. So these are indications, again, about how imperial an object this is and how important these New World to the Europeans discoveries were in terms of these spaces and how important it is, in Agnesi's view, that Europeans understand them and can locate them properly. Mm.
And is it fair to say the scale keeps wobbling around based on the imperial and the commercial interests? So you have some detail, as you described it, in South and Central America and in the Caribbean. But then you go over to Southeast Asia. India has a very, what looks to me like a rather old-fashioned sort of classical Greco-Roman tradition. It's quite tiny. And then again, the Moluccas, the Spice Islands in the in the far corner, right-hand side, are also in some detail. Is there that sense in which the scale is sort of zooming in and out based on the political and the commercial interests?
Absolutely. And commercial interests are going to be exaggerated. We can also look to the north, where we seem to have Scandinavia extending all the way to the North Pole, which would suggest perhaps that a northeast passage is not viable. But then if you look across the Atlantic, you'll see that there is a strait between Newfoundland and what looks actually like Maine. Well, they wouldn't have really known it to be that at the time. And that is most likely a derivation of the findings of Verrazano. And that, again, is suggesting that, oh, maybe this northeast passage won't work for people who wanted to go that way. But northwest looks like there might be a viable way over North America or through it. And then again, to get to China even faster, because they're hoping farther north, it's easier to sail across the Pacific than it would be at its greatest extent in the equator. Now, Jerry, if we could turn from the screen we've been looking at with that example to the RGS example, which is just behind us, we can see it bound into a volume here.
Yeah. And this is the atlas with the world map in it, very similar to what we've been looking at. RGS copy, absolutely beautiful. So we're seeing something very similar with these beautiful wind heads, the green continents, the Magellan Line. But it's in a book, effectively. It's an atlas. But this is earlier than we might think of using this word atlas. Why is that, Katie?
Definitely. In some ways, this is a very academic conversation about what qualifies as the first atlas and what isn't. So typically, the first atlas is classified in 1570, and it's Abraham Ortelius's Theatrum Orbis Terrarum, or Theater of the World. And that is considered the first atlas because all of those maps were designed and printed by one person, and they were meant to be bound together as kind of one intellectual object. This and the Sunderland Collections example are also actually conceived of together by one workshop and were bound together. So in some ways, by that definition, this should also be considered an atlas. But usually the first atlas question is also a bit print-centric. So this is the first printed set that are that way is the 1570 Theatrum. And so we usually consider this, we call it a manuscript atlas, or we qualify it in some other way.
Mm. This is very interesting and complicated. We could carry on because the use of the word atlas doesn't even come until late in the 16th century. It's by somebody else, a guy called Mercator, who has this idea of the atlas. But then you do have this weird moment, as you've just described it, Ortelius says, theatre of the world, that it's like a theatre, which I think is amazing. And it's really important that we talk about this because you've just described that that's a print moment. But this is 1550, the Agnesi Atlas that we're looking at here, 100 years after the invention of print, but it's in manuscript. Why? Why wouldn't you use print at this point?
So print does not kill off manuscript. Video did not kill the radio star, as it should be. So basically, these two technologies are participating. They are living together in the same ecosystem, the same cultural space, but at the same time, they're serving different purposes. So this is a luxury item. It's heightened in gold. It's made basically on commission. So you would order one for your library. And so this is very different, kind of consider it more like a coffee table book or a very expensive photography album versus print, which at this point is providing people with objects to read and objects to use, but not in the same presentation way in the 1550 moment that we will get for print later in the 16th century. That's still quite experimental and early for print. Mm. So they're serving different needs and they are coexisting, and manuscript will coexist with print well into the modern period.
And I am itching to get into this because it is laid out here on a cushion, this atlas. I can't really touch it. Katie, can you just show me, because I think it's obviously going to be very exciting just flipping through and to see what we have. Can we start with, so we're looking at the world map, which is roughly in the center of, I'm going to call it a book, the atlas. Wow. Okay. So just take me back through what we're looking at. My goodness, a beautiful, beautiful cover. Just tell me about even the cover. This binding is stunning.
Sure. And this is where actually it's really interesting, because both the Sunderland Collection example and the Royal Geographical Society example are both in their original, what we call the Agnesi bindings. So these bindings, as far as we know, seem to be what the Agnesi workshop would issue them. And so they're standard issue. Then if you were wanting to have it match the rest of your library, you would have had it bound differently. So this would have been originally have four clasps that look like little hands. They're great. You can see the pictures online because the Sunderland Collection example has all four of their clasps on.
And you still have some. These are so cute.
We have two that are still with us, but they are not on the volume, sadly. So they live in the box with our atlas, but they're not connected.
So cute. They are little hands.
they're darling. But it's actually really interesting to look at the end papers here, because our example, as well as the Sunderland Collection, has manuscript editions. So they have people that have written things in here. Mm. And so our edition, just like the Sunderland Collection example, has a note from Henry Henries, who is a very early Cardo bibliographer. He's a historian who is actually kind of, he lives his life both in the US and Paris. And in the 1880s, he seems to be encountering a lot of these Agnesis. And when he does encounter them, he writes a note in them saying, this is an Agnesi atlas. I'm the foremost Agnesi scholar. Mm-hmm. I certify this. Mm. And so our examples both have those. The RGS example then has additional from a guy, we have a book plate here, so someone's dead. And this is from Henry Yates Thompson, who's a very famous manuscript collector. He's more famous for collecting medieval illuminated manuscripts, usually religious texts, so Book of Hours and things like that. But he did have a couple of atlases in his, what he called his 100. So Yates Thompson is famous because he had one of the best collections in the world, but he was about quality, not quantity. So he had 100 top manuscripts, and then if he got a better one, he would kick one out.
Wow.
But this is really neat because this is one of the 10 volumes he inherited from his grandfather, who we have a note from here in the book saying how much he bought the volume for in 1826 in Rome. And so he gave 10 of these volumes to start Henry Yates Thompson collecting, and this one stays in the 100 his entire
Always.
Life.
So how important are donations like Thompson's? I mean, this is from quite some time ago, but is this a sort of ongoing process of getting those donations? And is that important for the society here?
Certainly. So we have been very lucky to benefit from, we have a fellowship at the Society, so you can be a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society. Yates Thompson was a fellow most of his adult life. And so thankfully, he donated a few atlases to us over the course of his collecting. And then this came to us at the bequest of his wife when she passed away in 1941. So we are utterly dependent on donations like this to grow our collection, and have been since we were founded as a society in 1830. But it's not just us. Absolutely every large institution and library is dependent to some extent on donations like this.
And it is one of the great 16th century manuscript map atlases, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it is one of the most premier things, I think. Can we have a look at it? Can we go further into it and dig into it? Because I'm really excited to have a look at it.
Certainly can. So both the Sunderland Collection and the RGS examples are what we might call a standard Agnesi, which has between 10 and 13 charts. And most of them, not all, will also have what we have here, which is a coat of arms. So this is a coat of arms kind of telling us about an early owner or who it was probably commissioned by. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we have not been able to identify this coat of arms, but would like to do so.
So how many charts do we have here, Katie?
So we have 13, as does the Sunderland Collection example, and they cover the entire world. But my favorite chart is this one, which is showing, it doesn't seem to show much, but it's actually showing all of the Pacific as it was understood at the time. So on the right here, which is towards the east, we have part of South America. We're missing a large part of the coast of what is today Chile. We have our Strait of Magellan, again, separated from Tierra del Fuego, and it has actually a lot of place names, which are suggesting that he is au fait with the Magellan account, which does add a lot of usually quite depressing place names here about smoke and cold and wind and fire. And then, of course, Tierra del Fuego comes from the number of fires they saw from the indigenous peoples that were living there. And then we go up and we have some coastline of California. There again, we have that Vermilion Sea. We have Tenochtitlan shown again. And then we just have this vast expanse in the middle where we really only have two small islands again, Tiburones and Sao Paulo, St. Paul, which were named by Magellan. And then we kind of go all the way across both of sheets of the opening here until we get over to a few very uncertain and partial coastlines, which are going to be making up again those Moluccas or those Spice Islands and part of the Philippines, which is where Magellan spent time. And then we do have a very ornate palace that's showing China and the powerhouse that was China in the 16th century. And that's kind of all this does. But I find this really important because it's one of the earliest charts or maps to focus exclusively on the Pacific.
And it's using this technique that we would call this a Portland chart, which is for strictly navigational purposes of quite small stretches of sea. But they're not really being used for navigation, are they? Can you just explain what's going on here with this use of this style that we call Portolan, but it's really for presentation purposes? So it's doing different things, isn't it?
So Portolan charts are covered in these lines that we can see. They're gorgeous and they all intersect and it looks kind of like a geometry teacher's nightmare. But they are all there for a purpose. They are all corresponding to cardinal directions on a compass or wind directions for some of the older ones. And then you would want, basically, if you're going, you would find a line that is parallel to the course that you want to chart. And then you would use that to actually divine where you want to go. So it's actually a tool to help you to navigate, not just a reference, so you can kind of know where you're going. So again, this is an elite object meant for a library. It is in no way meant to, disclaimer, do not take this on your ship and go use it to try and cross the Pacific.
You will die.
So Portolan style charts are useful particularly for smaller coastlines. They're traditionally used in the Mediterranean, where you actually don't need to correct so much for the curvature of the Earth when you're navigating. So there's a lot of technical reasons for that. But the wider space you show, the larger space you show, particularly north to south, the Portolan style is less effective. So here, this is really a stylistic throwback. It is kind of antiquing basically this chart to look old style while also having this new information. And I think it's that clash of old and new and the way that those are actually not clashing, that they're correlating, that what Agnesi is capitalizing on.
Katie, many of us in map history land come to it from various different backgrounds and contexts. What's your journey into the world of maps?
Sure. So I was a history major at university in the US. I was very interested in how Europeans learned about the world, so where that firsthand knowledge came from, which led me to be really interested in the history of exploration, specifically Pacific exploration. And so I was trying to understand where all this information is coming, and I kept coming across maps and charts. And so to be able to understand the research topic, I had to become an expert in maps and charts, as well as globes, actually. And so as I was doing my dissertation research, history of maps and mapping became an ever more important part of my argument about knowledge and knowledge production in the 18th century. And so that also then led, after I finished my PhD, to working with a map dealer. And I was not involved in the buying and selling, but I was very involved in the research. So we have a huge online collection at Ruderman Antique Maps, and I would be doing the very kind of thick description cataloging that you can find on that website. And that allowed me also to see many, many different types of maps from many different centuries, many different origins. And that kind of expertise then led me to be quite well suited for the job I have now, which is at the Royal Geographical Society. For we do have some earlier items like this. We go back to the 1470s as the earliest of our cartographic holdings. But then we also go right up until this very moment, and we're accepting into the collection maps that were made yesterday, basically. Mm-hmm.
And as a historian, what is it you think that maps can do to the historical record that maybe are different from other artifacts? I mean, you could use a painting, you could use a literary text. What is there something specific you think that maps bring to that historical account, or are they just part of the wider mix? Is there something significant, you think?
I think there's two ways to answer that. One, yes, I think there is something specific about maps, and that's the way that they combine the textual and the visual. And that's why to be a map specialist, you need to master things like the way manuscripts are made, the way that print is done, but specifically visual print, because it's a different print process than it would be for typeset print, although you need to understand that as well. So you need to understand how textual kind of worlds are doing, but also visual and aesthetic worlds. And by that, I mean both what geographers are thinking in terms of how mapping should look, but also obviously art history and paintings, because those are clearly influencing Agnesi in the way that those wind heads are drawn and the way that people in his workshop are creating their things. So I think that maps are particularly interesting because they are windows into a lot more than you would kind of normally expect from one single document. Mm. And they touch across visual, textual, and really cultural history in a way that I think other documents don't necessarily touch all of in such a succinct way.
Katie, it's been a real pleasure to come here to the RGS to look at this incredible atlas and also just be in this space, because it's such a resonant place, I think, for the history of maps and exploration and discovery. I think what you're doing is amazing. Thank you so much for joining me on What's Your Map?
Thank you for the opportunity to share our collection and also to look at Oculi Mundi, which is always a pleasure.
Pleasure, Katie. Goodness, it feels like we've only just scratched the surface when it comes to uncovering the history that sits within the Royal Geographical Society. Hopefully we can visit Katie again soon. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch at Whistledown Studios. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland Collection of Antique Maps and Atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland Collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.